information about Philip is at a premium. We know very little about him. It is known that he is from Bethsaida, the city of Peter and Andrew. Bethsaida means fish house, and was so called because it was the center of a thriving fishing industry. Most of the men who lived in Bethsaida were fishermen by trade. Peter and Andrew were, and we would assume that Philip was also. The name Philip actually means lover of horses, but though such a name might betray a man's natural love for animals, it provides scant information for determining the character of his life. Philip is a Greek name. It strikes us as being odd that in a day when Jewish resentment was so high against the barbarian Greeks, a Hebrew father should name his son Philip. It is possible, however, that the name was given out of respect for Philip the Tetrarch of Iturea, who had brought prosperity to the little town of Bethsaida. The city had become the capital of the province. Better housing had been provided, better jobs, and people were coming to live in the town of Bethsaida. Possibly Philip's father felt that the least he could do to show his appreciation to Philip was to name his son for him. Of course, this is pure conjecture. We really know nothing of the background or private life of this disciple. Save for the fourth gospel, we would know absolutely nothing about him. But from the four incidents which surround him there, we can assume several things about his personality. Apparently, Philip was born with a big heart and a little head. Now, by this I do not mean that he was physically deformed. Rather, I speak figuratively. His heart was right, but his head was dull. As a boy in school, he was never at the top of his class, not even near it. His grades were never as good as they should have been, and often he doctored up his report card before giving it to his parents. It was a kind of joke among the school children that Philip could never figure anything out. Everything had to be explained twice, and even then he often did not get it. Like boys, we all know, he was better at sports than at books. He could carry the ball over the goal line when on the football field, but at the end of a school year, he invariably found that he had not gotten far from the line of scrimmage in the academic world. One of the most lovable characters in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs is Dopey. He reminds us a little bit of Philip. Philip was a good guy, whom everybody liked, but he was a little dopey. As in school, so in business, he was never in charge of his own fishing boat. It just wasn't his nature to take any business risk. He was always afraid of bankruptcy, of overinvesting himself, lest a depression catch him unawares. He always played it safe. Possibly he never got married. Polycrates, ancient bishop of Ephesus, speaks of Philip's three daughters, two of whom grew old in virginity in Hierapolis, and one of which died in Ephesus. But there was so much confusion between Philip the deacon and Philip the apostle that we cannot be certain that Polycrates is referring to the right Philip. It would have been in keeping with Philip's nature never to have gotten married. There was too much risk in that kind of thing. He calculated the dangers and decided that it was too dark to take the leap. His fears were like those of the spinster who said that the reason she never got married was that she was afraid that she might have children and live in an old house, and a storm might blow the chimney down on them and kill them. As Fred C. Kelly says in Ken Hubbard, some fellers get credit for being conservative when they're only stupid. Had Philip served on the church board, he would have been the cautious kind. Consistently, he would have cautioned against overspending. He would have been pessimistic about any endeavor of faith. Anytime the budget needed to be raised, he would have voted against it. If there were a building project, he would have voted against that. He was certainly not a disciple of the positive thinking school. His mind was entirely too matter-of-fact for that kind of thing. He was too practical. Always he looked at the dark side, at possible failure. Many years ago, at a World Series game in Chicago, Babe Ruth pointed to the distant fence and swore that he would knock the ball over it. The crowd nearly tore down the place when the ball obeyed the decision of the great ball player. After the game, a reporter asked Babe what he would have done had he missed the last strike, and he replied in astonishment, "Why, I never thought of that." Philip would have thought of nothing else. He would have never understood a man like Babe Ruth. Philip always was thinking of the third strike and fearing that he might fail. He thought negatively. The night drew near, and the disciples suggested that Jesus send the crowds he had taught on the mountainside home to eat. Christ suggested that the disciples feed them. And it was Philip who said, 200 pennyworth of bread is not sufficient that all may have a little. That is to say, $40 would not buy enough bread for each to have a bite. His reasoning was the same as always. We can't do it. Where would we get the money to feed 5,000 men, plus women and children? The trouble with Philip was that he failed to take Christ into account. Mary and Martha had been guilty of the same thing. When Jesus came after the death of Lazarus, they said, "If you had been here, our brother had not died." What they failed to remember was that nothing ever gets so far out of hand that Christ cannot do something about it. And we are all like Philip and the sisters of Lazarus. We worry ourselves into frustration over our problems simply because we fail to take Christ into account. We forget that what seems a problem to us is not a problem to him. Philip discovered that a small lunch given to God can bless a multitude. How foolish he must have felt when he stood there and watched as 12 baskets of fragments were taken up after the meal. Your talents and gifts are not too small to give to Christ. Your abilities are not too insignificant to yield to him. Don't forget that when Christ is added to your smallness, the whole system of mathematics must be altered. 2 plus 2 is no longer 4, but it becomes 5. Jesus must have had to have much patience to put up with people like Philip. His brain was so slow-moving, so dense. He was so thick-headed. While Peter was always a jump ahead, Philip was always a jump behind. He never quite caught step with his master. And so he was always fearful of responsibility, of making decisions. When a group of Greeks came saying, "We would see Jesus," he did not know what to do. It was just not cricket to be too friendly with the Greeks. So, fearful of deciding for himself, he took them to Andrew, in hopes that someone else would decide, would take the lead and get these people off Andrew's back and get him off the hook. He could never get some things through his head. Never could he get it straight that God is no respecter of persons. Like many of us, he had trouble recognizing that a Christian should love and accept all men, regardless as to their race, their creed, or their color. And that without any question whatsoever. All this is an indication that Philip never fully knew his Lord. Shortly before the crucifixion, Jesus talked with his men about some very beautiful things, about heaven, the Father's house with many rooms. Thomas said, "We know not where you're going. How can we know the way?" And Christ replied, "I am the way. No man cometh unto the Father save by me." Then it was that Philip, finding all this talk too abstract, asked, "Show us the Father, and it sufficeth us." Or to put it in modern terms, "Let us see the Father, and we'll be satisfied." If we could just look at God, just get a glimpse of him, our problems would all be gone. That's the hunger of every age, isn't it? The hunger of every individual. Yet all the ancient holy men of God have reasoned that it is impossible to see the divine spirit. Job knew that in the world in which he lived, and yet he was sure that in the life to come he would someday see God. And so he said, "Though after my skin worms have destroyed this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God." But how it would have helped poor, suffering Job if he could have had a glimpse of God's face in the midst of his great trials. How it would help all of us to see the invisible, to have the spiritual clothed with the physical, in our sorrow and our pain, in our disappointment and our disillusionment. We cry, "O God, where are you? Let me see your face. If you are still there, please help me to know it." But the clouds never separate enough for us to see his face. And often we are faced with dilemmas which cannot be solved without a glimpse of God. Well do we understand the feeling of the woman who wrote to Helen Chapel White describing the fateful accident which took the lives of her husband and her two children, and then adding, "Up to that time, I had believed in a God who was kind and loved men. To put it baldly, I can't believe in such a God anymore." God was very real to Nancy Hanks, but Lincoln always had trouble conceiving of God. Carl Sandburg, in his voluminous work on Lincoln, says, "He tried to make pictures in his head of the face of God, far off and away in the sky, watching Kentucky, Hodgenville, Knob Creek, and all the rest of the world he had made. How it would have helped Lincoln to have seen the Father. How it would help us all." But though Philip's question was asked out of human dullness, we are all glad he asked it. Had he not asked, perhaps Jesus never would have said, "He that hath seen me hath seen the Father." And that puts a new color on the canvas, doesn't it? What he was saying was that if one knows Christ, he also knows God. If one sees Christ, he also sees God. Christ is the revelation of the Father. He is just like God. When Charlotte was only 3 years old, she came to breakfast one morning and blurted out, "I had a dream last night. I saw God up in the sky." "What did he look like?" asked her mother. There was no answer. In a moment, she said, "I saw Jesus, too." "What did he look like?" asked my wife. She answered, "He looked like God." That is profound theology, though it came from the lips of a three-year-old. Not only does Christ look like God, he is like God. This was the lesson Christ was trying to teach Philip. But though Philip did not understand everything about this business of religion, he did know that something wonderful had happened to him. He was a natural pragmatist. Always he was asking, "Does it work?" And of the many things he had found which did not work, he had found one that did work. This faith stuff was real for Philip. He couldn't explain it because he could not understand it, but he knew something had happened. And when he came after Nathaniel, argument would have been futile anyway. No skeptic is ever convinced by argument. If he is convinced at all, it will be by a simple-hearted Christian who knows something has happened to him and desires to share it. Huxley, the 19th century skeptic, was guest at a house party in the country when Sunday morning came and most of the guests prepared to attend church. Of course, he did not go. As a simple but radiant Christian man was about to leave, Huxley said, "Suppose you stay home today and tell me what Christ means to you." "But," said the man, "I cannot argue with you. You would tear my arguments all to pieces." "But I don't want to argue. I just want you to tell me simply what Christ means to you," said Huxley. So the man stayed and told him simply what Christ meant to him. After a while, there were tears in Huxley's eyes as he said, I would give my right hand if I could believe that. What was it that moved the great skeptic? Not argument. It was simply one man telling what Christ had done for him in a simple testimonial way. That is always the best. Propaganda was not enough for Nathanael. He very well knew that no great prophet had ever hailed from the backward town of Nazareth. Nobody needed to tell him that. That was common knowledge. Why should circumstances change now? So Philip said simply, "Come and see for yourself. Look at the church, which has grown from 12 simple men to over 700 million people across the world. Look at the work of missions, and then say there is nothing to this business of Christianity? Come and listen to Christ, and watch him as he works, and see then if you can still doubt. Forget about Nazareth. Forget about the many inexplainables. As Coleridge said, try it. Do not talk to me of the evidences for Christianity. Try it. Love him for yourself. You do not need to take my word or anyone else's word for it." There is an old story about a little boy returning home from the store with a jug of honey. A man asked, "Is that honey sweet, Jimmy?" Without a word, the boy set the jug down, unscrewed the cap, poked his dirty thumb into the honey, and brought it out dripping. Holding it aloft, he said, "Taste and see for yourself." Perhaps one of the greatest things about Philip is that he was faithful in spite of his density. He had always been naturally inclined to religious faith. From his childhood, he had been brought up, nourished in the cradle of faith. All his life, he was devoted to the Hebrew hope. When John came preaching repentance, he was baptized, because he wanted to be prepared for the coming kingdom which John was talking about, and which every Jew had looked for since the days of Abraham. He was indeed looking for the Messiah. Undoubtedly, he must have been an astute student of prophecy, insofar as he could understand prophecy with the density of his mind. When he found Nathanael, he said, "We have found him of whom Moses wrote in the law and the prophets." Without question, Philip believed he had found the Messiah in Jesus Christ. Of course, he didn't understand what all that meant. Sometimes we do not understand what all that means, but we know that we have found in Christ the one who has been waited for by men and women for all the centuries of time, the one who is the fulfillment of every prophetic dream and aspiration. Actually, however, Philip had not found Christ any more than we find Christ. Actually, Christ had found him like he finds us. In our text, Jesus is said to have found Philip and said, "Follow me." God is not lost, we are lost. We do not have to find him. He finds us in our sin, even as the shepherd sought until he found the one lost sheep. Who was it that said, "We would not be able to seek thee, O God, if thou hadst not already found us"? There is a point, then, where the seeking Christ finds the seeking man. Philip and Christ had crossed one another's path at that point. There is an old legend from Clement of Alexandria, from about 200 A.D., which says that the man who said to Jesus, "Let me first go and bury my father," was Philip. Indeed, this would be in keeping with his nature. But one can hardly believe it, since there is no hesitation in the biblical account when Christ called him. He believed Christ was the Messiah, and he cast his lot with him. And once he had caught the Spirit of Christ, Philip became contagious. Like Andrew, who had brought his brother Peter to Christ, so Philip brought his friend Nathanael. This always follows true conversion. Every truly converted man or woman becomes a witness, introducing other people to Jesus. Everyone who knows Christ wants other people to know him. A West Point chaplain tells of a soldier home from the war who went into a New York bookstore whistling a happy tune. The salesgirl said, "My, but somebody's happy." "Sure," he said, "I've just gotten back from Europe and a year in a German prison camp." "Well, that's enough to make anybody happy," said the girl. "But it wasn't just that," said the boy. "You see, while I was in prison, someone gave me an old, worn copy of a religious novel which told about people who met Jesus and what a wonderful thing happened to them. And you know, it happened to me there in prison. And when I got home to my wife, I could tell that she needed something. So I've come to get a copy of that book for her to read. I want what happened to me to happen to her." So it was with Philip. Something wonderful had happened to him, and he wanted it to happen to his friend, too. Finally, we must say, Philip was faithful in a small place. That's important. That's the great need of the church today, isn't it? Men and women who will be faithful in labors where there is little or no reward or recognition. He would never have led a great revival or conducted a church conference, but he would have substituted for an absent teacher in church school, and he would never have thought it beneath his dignity to clean the church restrooms. As the world counts greatness, he never achieved any. We hear no more of him after the upper room. Suddenly he disappears. But this does not mean he ceases to be a disciple, or that his life did not count for Christ. Rather, it probably means that he was faithful in some unknown ministry. He was regular, steady, and faithful, and Christ must have loved him for it. His death was what we would expect of a loyal Christian like Philip. In 195 A.D., Polycrates, Bishop of Ephesus, writes to the Bishop of Rome a letter in which he speaks of Philip's death taking place in Hierapolis. A legend says that he was responsible for the conversion of Lady Nicanaia, wife of a Roman proconsul, and that the proconsul was so enraged that he had him crucified. Before he died, he requested, however, that his body be wrapped in papyrus rather than linen, for he was not worthy to be buried as his lord. Philip saw through a glass darkly all his life until that day in Hierapolis. Perhaps that would imply that he was a greater martyr than those who saw clearly. Like many saints of God, he had learned that if we begin the web, God will supply the thread. We know very little of the background of Philip. Just little pictures like these we have noticed from the fourth gospel give us our only insight into his character and his personality. Slow, a little dense, careful, always a follower and never a leader. And yet, what we have learned in these few short moments can make better men and women of us all. Like Philip, where we cannot see, we must walk by faith. The reward for those who walk by faith will be much brighter than the reward of those who understood it all perfectly and who had no questions and no reason for confusion or doubt. May God bless us, then, as together we make our way through the world en route to the house of God and his guest, Philip.